Following is Chris Baum's talk, Myths to Design By, from the 2013 Information Architecture Summit.
The 2013 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by User Interface Engineering. Stay tuned after the podcast for a special offer from UIE.
So thanks for coming. You are the brave ones. This is a presentation I've been working on in my head for a very, very long time. It's actually sort of started one day when I caught a PBS program that I'll discuss in a little bit, and proceeded to go buy it from PBS and devour it 5 times. I'd talked about myth when I was a kid, but didn't register. I was like, oh yeah, old guys, throwing bolts of lightning, horses with wings. Okay, awesome. Good stories, what do they mean to me? Boy, did I get an education. So my name is Chris Baum. I come from San Francisco now. I've been there since 1998. I am a UX consultant. After spending about 8 or 9 years working in companies as a design strategist, I eventually went on my own and have recently started a new design firm called Future Draft. We do co-creation with our clients. Basically, we get in a room and we do most of our work in the room with them as much as possible. It's crazy fun. We just started. You know, keep tabs on us. We hope to have great news coming up. That's Milo. He's my bud. He's the one that keeps me on the toes. So as I was mentioning, I've been working on this for a very long time. I am sort of an extroverted introvert. I really love to hang out with people. One-on-one is my favorite. But I don't mind getting up here and doing this every once in a while. It's all good. But I'm certainly not an extrovert. I think some people might be surprised by that. But I really, this is my family, and so I always feel really comfortable here. I hope you feel the same if you're new. And I also am an intuitive thinking person and use that intuition to perceive things. This is the Myers-Briggs, if you're not familiar. And those are my parents. You may or may not be surprised, and in talk about myth, I might mention my past. Not that we know all that much about it, but there are 2 significant things. 1, my dad was raised Jewish. 2, my mom is a very active Methodist. Nice. And so I grew up in a family where the idea of someone was right just really wasn't an argument. So it was always this thing, well, here's these aspects of one thing and here are these aspects of another. And I honestly think that that's not only served me in my career, it's also kind of set up the ideas that allowed me to come here today. Now, what we're not talking about is this myth, or this myth, which I published, and this myth, and these myths. You get the idea. Myths in the vernacular often mean lies, but that's not really their function. We're talking about this kind of myth. You know, the gods with the lightning bolts and the horses with wings and, you know, jeweled nets that hold all the humans in existence. And while they seem like fantastical stories, they actually encode the deepest truths of our existence. So why talk about it here? You know, this is a UX conference. This is the IA Summit. We're talking about complex problems using data and reasoning to solve things. But yet, we have gods. I have to thank Andrea Rosmini for that, and Jorge for showing it to me yesterday. Oh my God, is that not the best ever? And we have unicorns. And sketches. And the nice thing about this one is not only is it a sketch, but it has a piece of art representing the rest of art. So symbolism writ large. We have culture. We have story and the use of mythic images as modifiers. We have symbols. Except for the first 2 pictures, those were all taken this weekend. Oh no, the first 3 pictures, apologize. Okay, so what does myth really mean? It's not just winged horses and gods throwing bolts of lightning. It has to do with culture. So first, we need groups of people, because groups of people need to relate to each other. You know, at first, maybe they're milling around the brush and, you know, killing rabbits and eating them and kind of grunting at each other. But at some point, someone has to be able to transmit the meaning of that culture. And the myths do that. There are a range of things. There are stories and symbols and objects and rituals that connect the real meaning of people's lives to each other and help you understand where you're in a particular culture. So basically, they give you that underlying foundation so that when you enter an inner family and start to live out in the culture, that it's not just people telling you what to do, that there's ways for them to show you at really symbolic levels what it means to be a part of that culture. How many people know this guy? Awesome, okay. So his name is Joseph Campbell. He was a professor at Sarah Lawrence University, and what he studied was comparative religion. And what he did was, he decided that most religious scholars went in to study other religions with a viewpoint. So if a Christian Jesuit went to China to study Buddhism or Taoism, they were filtering it through their filter. And so when they came back, they gave the Christian version, which is how you got demonization of some of those cultures. He said, that doesn't make any sense, because when I meet people who are Indian, he had traveled a lot in Europe studying in the 20s, when I meet these people, they're amazing people. There's nothing demonic about them, and their myths and their cultures are rich with history that we can't even touch. And so what he did is he became a pattern finder, or, heaven forbid, an architect, and assembled an architecture for the world's mythologies. It's called Massive's God. It's very large. I don't suggest it as an evening read. It's more of like a, oh, book. Oh, that's really interesting. It's really amazing. Now, he's also the one that popularized something called the Hero's Journey. I'm sure most of you have heard of that. That's the mythic structure that Star Wars is based on. It is the basic myth structure that appears in pretty much every single mythology that is in existence today, or was in existence ever, I guess. The interesting thing that he said that really got me thinking about this was this quote. That in every instance, through human history, until we reach the modern age, all mythologies were bounded. The technology was such that you really didn't leave the place that you grew up in, or you moved around with your group, and maybe you came across people at certain times, but in most cases, there was a very easy way to discern yourself from others. So the job of the myth was to define you in that group, and it very easily made boundaries around people. Who knows who this is? Carl Jung. So he was a Swiss psychiatrist, and he studied clinical psychiatry and began a practice, and then started to realize something. That the clinical practice did not actually treat his patients. So what he started to do was started to interview them and ask them what they thought was going on with them. And he would ask them to write down their dreams in journals. And he would be watching them for patterns that he recognized from his clinical practice until he really had a rapport with them and really sort of understood what they thought they were going through. He did not apply that layer. In many ways, I think it's like us, where if we do a good job listening in our projects, we've listened for a long time before we start to provide solutions or to change the way that our clients are seeing their own problems. But that's our eventual idea, right? We want to help them define their problem in a way that we think we can solve and then use our best practices to come up with a solution to it. He came up with what now is called psychoanalysis. So not an informal process, but it's a very intense personal process between a doctor and a patient. And through this process, he himself went through some incredibly deep self-reflection. In fact, he wrote this huge thing called the Red Book, which was mostly him scratching down his dreams and his inspirations, some of them waking. And it's like a book about yay big, and it's been traveling around the world. It's this incredible thing. It's like the man was crazy talented. And he also built his own kind of ritual retreat on the lakes in Switzerland, in Basel. So he's very deep into the idea of interconnection. And so he also talked a lot about myth, and he and Campbell had a relationship. And so what he says is, a psychic break is a dissonance between what the conscious wants and is doing and what the unconscious wants and is perceiving is the right path. And I think we can all recognize, even neuroscience recognizes the fact that the conscious mind can only hold so much. But most of the time we say that the mind filters out all the additional stimuli. That's actually not true. It filters it out for your conscious brain, but your unconscious brain gets it all. Like when you all are looking at me, you're also looking at everyone in the room. You're seeing the entirety of the pattern of the carpet. You're seeing the presentation. You're seeing that light flickering up there. You're seeing, you know, this gentleman waving his foot, you know, everything. But you don't need that in most cases for your conscious mind. So what do myths do? Like, okay, great. So they connect us to culture, but how does that work? There's four parts of that. The metaphysical part is usually handled by religion or spirituality. That is understanding your relationship to the entirety of the universe. Ma. And that's pretty intense. I think that's a really interesting function. But what it also does is do what they call a cosmological function. And that means that using artifacts in real life to remind you of that metaphysical reality on a day-to-day basis. So when artists draw a picture of a tree, it's like this amazing thing, and it's like, oh my God, I never look at a tree like that. Well, that is trying to connect you to the fact a tree isn't just like a thing is wood and has some leaves, and they fall at a certain time of year if it's the right kind of tree. No, like it is constantly drawing out nutrients from the earth and trying to grow its way to the sky. That's its job. And it just does it. And it's amazing. I mean, as interesting and as smart as we are, it's hard for us to come up with something that we've made that's as cool as that. And so poetry and art does that. Now, the sociological function, that actually is a bit of a conundrum, because classically, myth, for sociological purposes, actually what it did was it rigidified that boundary around a culture. And so it was drawing the boundary saying, this is where you belong, so don't go past that. And you see that today a little bit in, if you come home from school and you've been playing with a friend of yours and you're mimicking them and they say, well, oh, hey, stop acting like Johnny. You're Paul. You're not Johnny. Wait a minute. Like, you're just combining and becoming yourself. Like, this has nothing to do with, the mimicry may or may not be about Johnny. But that's what the sociological realm of myth does. It says, you have taken a certain place in this society and your job is to be that. And they don't like it when you go past it. And then finally, the psychological. The function of myth there is for stories and rituals to help you go through the pathway of life, from birth to childhood to adulthood to death. Things like bat mitzvahs and bar mitzvahs do that, christenings, retirement is one of those things. And there's all kinds of stories and symbols and myths around that. Now, the big question that kind of brings us here is, why is that important now? Okay, so let's imagine there's that one culture, and they have their boundary. There's another one over there, and they have their boundary. And then there's another one over here, and you know, humans do a pretty good job of procreating, so eventually, you know, cultures sort of grow and change out of each other. And eventually we can do what we've done, which is basically cover the earth with cultures. And now they're all overlapped. And what technology has done is accelerated that overlap. Because, you know, back in the 1920s, you could never see someone from India your entire life. Unless you went to Europe or you, say, went to New York and they made the 3-month trip to Europe. But technology is accelerating that and has made it basically something like this. And what this represents isn't just the electronic connections. This is an envisioning emerging cultures that overlap completely. So now you can be part of the mom culture, part of the finance culture, part of the design culture, and part of the family culture all at once. And so we're constantly changing these things. Like when we come here, we're entering a culture that we usually only see electronically. So the question is, how do we design in that context? Most of our tools are designed to isolate a problem that the moment we stop being isolated on it, then goes away and becomes a different one. Why is that? Because, like I said before, our practices are for rational use. They come from rational places. Some of the things that we're using now, things like the sticky notes and sketching, those start to let things emerge. So though I think those are really good. But my question is, can we do more? Because what I'm really looking for is balance. It's trying to find a way to balance the amount of practice that we have that's rational and that amount we have that's based on the unconscious. And I realize that's a stretch. So I'm willing to, like, you know, just take a few steps toward that. And this isn't, I'm not making this stuff up either. So Andrew Hinton did a great presentation on Friday morning. I was really lucky. My airplane was late. I came in. He was just starting, so I just went and sat down. And he gave me this great thing. So our brains, when we pick up a tool, that becomes part of our body. It's not conscious. We just do that. And I think we need to recognize that unconscious action there. Because if we don't do that, what we're saying is we're just going to let that happen and we're going to find a way to use it, but we're not going to try to understand how that changes the context of the person. And then he said this. We should know how the black boxes talk to each other, meaning the computers, of course. What about the cultures that we're connecting when we make those tools? Because what we're doing when we make a tool is we're creating an interface between cultures. And that means we're interacting with two different myths. So anytime an organization builds a tool for its customers, the organization and all of its internal people and all of their myths in collective interact with the cultures and attitudes and cultures and myths of all of the users of that tool. And I just believe that we're underutilizing that aspect of our practices. And I realize that I'm asking a lot here, and honestly, I don't have the answers. But I have thought about a few things. Oh, and I have an emoticon for Scott, Simple Scott. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're just going to take a quick trip through those four functions of myth and talk about how our practices kind of ally with those pieces. So first, the psychological. So we're talking about the individual aspect of understanding your place. Okay, think about yourself. I think that's pretty straightforward, but there's a lot in there. And I think by being here, a lot of you are doing that. You're reflecting on your practices. You're listening to other people. You're finding mentors. But also, are you giving yourself quiet time around your practice, not just in 3 days out of the year? Are you taking a look back at your projects when you're finished? Are you putting your projects on the wall and finding a way to take representations of them over the year and see how your practice is changing? Because then you'll be able to see patterns emerging, things where maybe you're letting things go, or things where you're learning things that you can recognize and share with others. And why is that important? Well, because in many ways, the UX culture is a manifestation of this force. And that's a very Western mythic force. It's the idea that when you are the one that's responsible, you make your own path, you have that choice. And you know, that story comes from a place where Arthur and the knights are sitting around the round table, they're about to have dinner. And Arthur says, you know, we're not eating until an adventure occurs. And of course, after a while, the Grail appears. So they decide to go off and find it. What they decided was that it would be really lame if they went off in a group. If they're really going to make an adventure out of it, they're going to go alone. They're going to find the craziest path up the biggest mountain. And that is a thing that we still see today. And you can even see it reflected in the cultures between Europe and the United States. Because, you know, even today in Europe, there is just a touch more formality, a recognizing of past, a recognizing of the myth. In the United States, the myth is that individual path. We have a very relaxed relationship with our authority figures. Like our presidents, even when we started the country, even though there was some debate about this, they didn't wear crowns or any real finery. They just wore their uniform if they had it, or they wore a suit. They did not have pomp and circumstance as much. So really, it's trust yourself. Because in the end, of course, you are responsible for your own path. And a lot of times we put the control of that in other people. And I realize that that's a really difficult thing to internalize. I myself have been in situations where I've done things that I knew were not right for me, but I was afraid. I, you know, was worried about security, or I didn't know it would do to my reputation. But in reality, if you really you get to know yourself at that deep level, you'll know what to do. And the other part of this one is help others do the same thing. I know our tendency a lot of time is when people are expressing what's going on with them, we tell them what we think they should do. But I'm asking you to think, what would Jung do? Let them talk it out first. Let them try to start making sense of it. And then slowly, as we would in our best way with our clients, help them come to their own realization with your help. Then there's the sociological. And I actually think this is a huge opportunity for us. Because with all those emerging cultures, those boundaries are gone. It doesn't matter what they were. People can try to like retract themselves, but they can't hide. So in our context, instead of this, I'd like to see us think of it like this. Instead of this, like this. And I mean, I do really believe that we are in a position, because we have the ability to understand all these different stakeholders and all their different perspectives and wrap those things into solution, I think we are uniquely positioned to actually deliver on this. My friend Jim Lefwich, he's an IA type guy in California, he said something to me the other day. He said, you know what? We're the people that when people have a scary, complex problem where there's no clear solution, they come to us. And I think that puts us in a position because we can take those complex patterns, whether they're rational or unconscious, and align them into a solution that's real. One way that I do that in my practice is I take my clients out of their work. We don't do a discovery phase of our projects, really. They might give us a few materials before the kickoff workshops, but we read them, we digest them, we look at their industry a little bit. But the real thing happens when they either come to our office or we meet somewhere remote. We get in a room. One time we got an Airbnb house and stayed there, took all the art off the walls, and papered the entire house for 4 days. It was awesome. It was a super complex industry. We learned about every player in their industry, all the things that they've done up to this point over the last 12 months, and they're a very directed startup, so they had done a lot of stuff. And we were, within 3 or 4 days, able to ramp up and actually start to find out what the solution was. And we used the sketches and the ideas that came out of that through the whole project. But also, let's be aware that we're not trying to line this up to take all the tensions out. We're not there to make it all Shangri-La. That's not the point. The point is for us to understand where those tensions need to be and understand where they're unnecessary. And that's by, in turn, listening to the different groups and understanding their positions and the things that they're thinking about and the things that they aren't thinking about but should, and find a way to align them in a way that gets us going in the momentum in the direction that we think will be the right one. And there's the cosmological. So this is the representation of nature to remind us of that greater us. So language is it. Language is the thing that makes things these days. Again, this is Andrew Hinton. Now this, besides being a lovely plant with some water on it, is an example of a Buddhist myth called Indra's net. I think I mentioned this before. This is the idea that everything in the universe is a bead on this net. And that bead reflects every other bead on the net. And this is powerful because what it does is it allows us to think about every decision we make gets reflected in every other decision we make. And if we can find ways to think about that in the context of our projects, and I'll be frank, I have no idea how to do that yet. I think that if we can just keep these ideas in mind, these deeper ideas of the relationships of people to their deeper truths in our projects, maybe we can get closer to this. And if anybody has any ideas, I'm hugely open to that. Because hopefully it can do something like this. That this iPhone thing that I put away. I mean, when you see people pull that out, I mean, that is not just an extension of their body. That is an extension of the entire universe. It's in there. Like, it's really incredible. And you see people touching it like they know it. And I think that's amazing. And if we can find a way to bring that kind of attention to all of our projects, I think that'll make a huge difference. Okay. I've gone out on a little bit of a limb so far, but I have to go one step further. Just because, I mean, I can't not talk about the metaphysical, right? I mean, I can stop now if you guys want to, but I think it's kind of boring. All right, so absolutes probably don't exist. I can't say they don't exist because that's circular. But really what we're looking at here is trying to find some balance. That understanding that life is a cycle, that all those tensions that exist, most of them have an equal and opposite that's right up against it that cannot exist without it. A guy named Alan Watts gives an interesting talk about the idea that an object does not exist without its background. So if none of these other things were here, I wouldn't be here, or you couldn't see me at least, because there's nothing for you to see me against or in respect to. So that perspective, I think, applies to this. And that illustrates why context is important. So what I'm hoping is that we can look for ways to help myths find professional dynamics in our lives. And I wonder, are we here? 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 Or are we everywhere all at once? I'd just like you to ask yourselves, why are you here? And just think about that. Thank you. Now, we do have time for questions, if anybody dares. You get a book. It's a really great book. It's Trevor Van Gorp's book from Morgan Kaufman.
So my question is, so my job, we frequently run up against people are holding so strongly to their own personal mythologies that they won't kind of get out of the way and let us do our job, because clearly their mythologies are more important than anything else. So I was wondering if you had any advice for that, any tips to kind of work around that.
That's a great question. I think that's something I probably should have expressed a little more, is that that's the thing, is without those boundaries, those cultures are emerging. What's happening is basically, instead of having a culture define you, you define yourselves in relation to all the cultures you're a part of. And so that is a very good example of that person holding to their own position in a way that doesn't necessarily reflect the culture they're having to participate in. And that's a hard problem. But here's the thing. Is there's probably a conversation that can be had with them. It's sort of like on the jujitsu kind of perspective, where you can do that thing where you let them talk about their issue and have them reflect on it. And obviously you can't be pedantic about it at them. But find a way to get them to reflect on it, and then you find the space you can get around their issue. Or what you might learn, the interesting thing is you might learn something that actually helps you change your direction. Does that answer your question? I mean, would you want me to tell you can ignore them? They're part of your culture. Hold on a minute. So that should not be your idea. It's about understand, like looking at it from enough directions that you figure out where the flow goes, basically. It's not to like do an end around them. It's at least either to get them lined up with you or find a way that you line up with them. It's not easy. I'm not saying this is going to be cake. Anyone else?
Isn't it possible, depending on the size of the project, that you need to create a new mythology?
Absolutely. Oh, we do that all the time. What do you think design principles are? If they're done well, they both satisfy the conscious needs, but they also drive people's unconscious execution of it. So when somebody is coding and they can think about those design principles, that's not just rational. But there's lots of things that we do with that. The sketching, that's like subrational many times. It's about mixing things up. You know, when you're putting together sticky notes and sketches and trying to make a collage out of them, that also kind of activates the unconscious mind as well. So yeah, it definitely is part of that. Anyone else? All right, well, thank you all very much for going along on the journey with me.
The IA Summit podcasts are sponsored by the UIE Virtual Seminar Program, with scores of online seminars your team can access on demand. For free access to a virtual seminar, visit uie.com/IAS13. And you can find the rest of the IA Summit podcasts at library.iasummit.org.